Welcome to the Conversations About Consultation podcast. I'm Zara Ahmed, and you're here listening to some of the conversations that myself and my co-hosts, Dr. Emily Canedo, Jessica Rowley, and Emily Crosby have had with guests from around the world about consultation and psychology. We all have a keen interest in consultation and hope that this podcast offers a platform to discuss different views about the topic and future directions for consultation. We hope that you enjoy listening to these episodes, and if you'd like any further information or are interested in being a guest, please feel free to let us know or get in touch via email or Twitter. On today's episode, we are so lucky to have with us Jeffrey Brown and Star Green Sky. Jeffrey Brown identifies as he, him, and is originally from Kingston, Jamaica. He currently resides in San Diego and is an assistant professor at San Diego University, where he teaches on the school psychology program. His research interests include the effects of discriminatory systems on minoritized populations, especially those who identify as LGBTQ plus youth of color. Jeff received his Bachelor of Arts in Psychology at Yale University and his PhD in Psychology with a focus on school psychology from Tulane University, where he also completed a pre-doctoral internship at the Louisiana School Psychology Internship Consortium. We are also really lucky to have with us Star Green Sky, who is also based in San Diego, California, and is currently working as a school psychology intern. She is Anishinaabe from Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota and Agwala Gota from Pinewood Reservation in South Dakota. Star has a background in sociology and child development with a minor in Indian American education. We really hope you enjoy listening to today's episode. Hi, Jeff and Star. It's so lovely to have you both here with us. We usually start by asking our guests about their journey to where they are now and kind of their current role and how they got here. And I was wondering if you would start by introducing yourselves and, you know, what piqued your interest about school psychology?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having us, Zara and Emma. So yeah, I'm Jeff. As you said, my pronouns are he, him. And I was actually born and raised in Jamaica, in Kingston. And I came to the U.S. when I was 18 for university. I thought I was going to be pre-med, but psychology kind of captured my heart instead. And, you know, looking back at it, even though no one in my family studied psychology, my mom is an economist and worked for the Central Bank of Jamaica for a very long time. And, you know, I had that kind of social science background growing up in the household. We would be watching the BBC and CNN and talking about social issues. And, you know, mental health is also a big interest of mine, just seeing that around me. You know, Jamaica, like so many other places, still very much emergent in terms of our mental health care. So it was very palpable. I saw it all around. So, you know, I wanted to do something that would, you know, very cliche, but help those around me, help develop my own society where I grew up, but also to contribute to the, you know, mental health development of people around me. That said, I, you know, joined a psychology lab in undergrad. So I joined Dr. Paul Bloom's lab doing moral development in kids. So I thought I wanted to do more social developmental psychology, but then saw all the school psych students being so stressed. And I was like, oh, I want to be stressed too. So I switched to school psych. I'm mostly kidding, but you know, the long and short of it, and that was at Tulane, where I went to grad school, is in Dr. Oscar Barbarin's lab. Was that I wanted clinical skills. I wanted to work in schools since I was doing my research in schools anyway. And I thought school psych would be the right fit for me because I wanted that application and not just that theoretical research. So that was kind of the long and short of it. The rest, as they say, is history. After grad school, I went to Minnesota State University, Mankato, where I was an assistant professor in their school psychology program. And then I came to San Diego State, where I'm now assistant professor of school psychology. And I think that's a long and short of it. That's a Cliff Notes version. But, you know, to the TLDR version, the too long didn't read version, is that thought I wanted to be a social psychologist, was very interested in things like, you know, systems of discrimination and prejudice. And but I also wanted to not just talk about these issues. I wanted to do something about them. So that led me to school psych.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you both for having me here. Buju, Gawin, Apiji, Ninita, Anishinaabe, Mose, Anang Green Sky, Nindijnikaz, Mekanak Nindurum, Gaza Kaskwajim Dunjba, San Diego Ninda. So hello again. My name is Star Green Sky. That's me speaking my native language. I'm Anishinaabe from Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota. And Oglala Lakota from Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I'm currently residing on the ancestral lands of the Kumeyaay people in what is now known as San Diego, California. And my journey to school psychology was really a very unexpected one. I think growing up, education was always a goal of mine and really a goal of my family's. I am the first in my family to, attend a four-year university, to graduate high school, and then to graduate with a bachelor's. So I remember being in my undergrad, and at the time I was studying sociology and child development, and I was minoring in American Indian education. And I was really loving what I was doing. I was loving working with families and students and youth. And I remember I had a professor, it was kind of a mentor. Her name is Dr. Keyshawn Lara Cooper. She's a wonderful Indigenous woman, just very bright and just so powerful. And I remember she had approached me one day and had asked me if I was thinking about grad school. And I just kind of gave her a funny look. And I was like, what do you mean? I got here. This was it for me. This is, I'm so super excited and just blessed to be here. But the more that she kind of pushed me and asked me some questions, well, what is it that you would like to do? What issues are you seeing? How would you like to go back to your community? I started thinking more and more critically about the issues that were coming up in my community as an Indigenous woman, the things that I cared about, and how to kind of push forward. And so school psychology has really given me that opportunity to give back to my community and contribute in a meaningful way. So thank you for having me.
That's amazing. It's so lovely to kind of hear such varied backgrounds and like the different cultures that are coming into like play. And I guess I'm also wondering, Jeff, you spoke a little bit about an interest in mental health and Star also kind of supporting communities. And I'm wondering what role consultation plays in that, really.
So that's a really good question. I would say that it plays a pretty big role. So in a couple of different ways. So like one is maybe more metaphorically, right? So, and I will say that I was trained in consultation at Tulane by Bonner and Stacey, who, was one of the consultation is her thing. And, I was trained by her more formally, but also kind of more informally, right? In a way that I didn't really know that was going on. So, every time a friend talked about a case that they were, having, and, we problem solved together, even as a grad student, that was consultation. We didn't really call it that, but between classes or what have you, or between or after practicum, and, classmate would be talking about a case, and this is in New Orleans, where I did graduate school, and it was a place where, some places relied on students or interns or what have you for, mental health supports. And so this would be legit, right? Like these little side conversations, they really had some sort of impact. But that was consultation. We didn't really know what we were doing at the time. But also, when we were talking about our own mental health, right? Like it starts from ourselves and how we were managing grad school or how we were managing things going on at home or things going on with our families or with our loved ones or what have you. Whether we're talking to each other, whether we're talking to our professors, whether we're talking to our mentors, that was like a form of consultation, right? So even though we were trained to recognize consultation, capital C consultation, as this, you talk to the consultee, or you talk to the client, or it's client-centered, it's consultee-centered, or what have you. Like even though we were trying to like label it in such a way, like we noticed that over time, these little things are consultation. So I mentioned all that to say that right now my role is, if more formally, I'm helping a school. I won't say the name of the school, but they're a international school in Germany that I'm helping with more systems-based consultation. And I've been working with them over the past year. I won't take too much credit for it, because I will say that one of their teachers has been working tirelessly. So they would be the consultee in this case. I'll be the, and I would maybe be the maybe be the consultant. But this teacher has been working tirelessly to do a survey about discrimination, especially racial, race-based discrimination, race ethnicity-based discrimination, religion-based discrimination, and sexual orientation, gender-based discrimination in their school. So the first step of that is to do a school-wide survey, the first of its kind, to figure out various to levels of discrimination that was going on, to maybe reform some of their system. So maybe they could improve their system school-wide to make it more supportive for students who are from minoritized backgrounds. But it's pretty major in that the administration has no sort of schema for it, right? So like, I won't necessarily pretend that a lot of places here are perfect. Here in the States, we're definitely far from it. But at least there is like language in the census about like, what is your race? What is your gender? What is your this? It was not very common in that state where they are to have that kind of language. So very much the mere asking about these identities, these categories, to some people that was discrimination. Does that make sense? So it's playing a pretty major role right now, in recognizing some of the more classical versions of it, right? Like, how do you get someone to, look at the system that they're in to transform it? But also, it's a pretty major in a very informal way. So, like, I feel like anytime I talk to a student about what's going on in their own life, right? So it's now I'm on the other side of it, right? Like, I'm talking to a student about what's going on with their own personal life, with their families, with their loved ones, with their friends. Right now, I'm anytime I talk to my other faculty members about how we can better support students, but anytime I talk to a student about how we can better support them. So I feel like it's both informally and formally in a lot of different ways.
I really want to echo what Jeff was saying as far as, consultation really happening on both like a formal and informal basis. I think a lot of my formal training, being a school psychology intern now, it started in the program, I guess you could say, right? Formally. I got to work with Dr. Colette Ingram, who is, one of the great pioneers in this field, and very honored and blessed to have been able to work with her. But I also think I want to echo what Jeff was saying as far as consultation really starting with ourselves, right? And kind of understanding who we are as practicing school psychologists, right? Our own positionality in different social structures and things like that. So although formally, I think it started in my graduate program, learning about the different consultation models and everything like that, I think informally, this training has really started since being a student myself in the public education system and understanding my own experiences as an Indigenous student and as an Indigenous woman. I think now being placed as a school psychology intern at a middle school, high school site, I am working in a school district that's in more of kind of a rural area, but they have a very high culturally and linguistically diverse student population, and also a very high Indigenous student population. So a lot of my role now is not only kind of understanding my own position, as now being on the other side. If I'm no longer just a student, right? I'm practicing. I'm in the field. But also understanding my position in really being an advocate and what that means and what that looks like as a consultant, right? So working with Indigenous students, working with culturally and linguistically diverse students, working with the families, kind of building that trust with the local community, I think has been so extremely important to my work. That's been, I think, the breadth of the work is building that trust in the community, right? And then also trying to bridge the relationship, I think, between the students and the families that I work with, and also, right, the public education system as a whole. So a lot of the staff that I work with and the educators and the administrators. So trying to bridge those two entities, I think, is kind of what consultation has been all about for me. I think it also has been such a great experience to really explore how to use my experience as an Indigenous woman, but also the knowledge that I have, right? A lot of the historical kind of context that I'm aware of, that I know about, to really inform these interactions as well. Yeah, that's a little bit about how I think consultation plays really just a huge role in the work that I'm doing with students and families.
And if I may kind of just add on to that, Star, I will say that myself and the other fellow faculty is something that we try to convince our students. So, you know, Star and her colleagues, her fellow students over the years, is that you have so much inherent knowledge. Like, you have expertise. Like, it's not only about kind of like the book learning that, you know, we impart on you. It's not about like how many tests you know how to do, right? Like, each of you brings these unique set of experiences. And so I'm really glad, Star, that you mentioned that, and that, you know, you own that, right? And that is, it's really, really important in terms of like advocating for students and families.
It's so interesting. I guess when you were talking, Star, one of the things that struck me was that thing about your own self-awareness and self-knowledge and how you know and understand yourself in a wider system. And how critical that is to be able to look both inward and outward. How can I bring myself into the work, and how can I know and understand myself well enough that actually I accept that I'm flawed and have blind spots or biases or stereotypes or whatever it might be, and how do I do the both and? I felt was you know, really coming through in what you were speaking to. I think the other thing that the both of you have really kind of brought back to me is that Kaplan's idea about interpenetrating frames of reference. There's maybe less point in just seeing consultation as being very traditional client-centered without really trying to think about what systems are clients, consultees, consultants, etc. in. And the idea that each of the, like, how we feel internally has an influence on our relationships with others. Those relationships have influences on groups. That group has an influence on the wider kind of community or structure within a school or assessing. And actually, I suppose it's the complexity of what we're asking of ourselves, and I guess of consultees to engage in consultation, is, you know, if it's done well and done thoughtfully, it can be such a powerful tool for really trying to understand what really is kind of going on, or how might we be able to affect change. It was, yeah. Just lots of really interesting things kind of sparking off. And I don't know, Zara, about that, what we would call like a self-awareness and critical kind of placing of oneself in role. If what Jeff and Star have been speaking to kind of resonates for you on any level.
Yeah, definitely. I think as you were both speaking, I was like, oh, what Emma taught us in first year, self-enroll. but yeah, I think it is really important to have that self-reflection. And Emma, what you were saying, you know, going into consultation, I guess knowing that, you know, we're not perfect. And I think that's actually really helpful for consultation, in terms of, I know that I'm coming in with specific knowledge and expertise, but there's also lots of things I don't know. And the consultee is there to share that experience with us, rather than me coming in and being like, this is what you do. I guess, you know, today we want to talk a little bit about Jeff, the paper you wrote recently in 2022. And that was kind of our first encounter with your work. And it was on a multicultural, gender and sexually diverse affirming school-based consultation framework. But really interesting paper. And we would just love if you could give us some background and kind of context on this work, like some of what you notice and what prompted kind of that thinking, and some of the concerns you were conscious of in the systems and schools you were working with.
Of course, thank you. So the paper came out officially in 2022, but the idea for it came around 2018, 2019, actually. And I do want to mention my colleagues and my co-authors, so Shireen Nasser at Cleveland State University, Charity Brown Griffin at Winston-Salem State University, North Carolina, Sally Grapin at Montclair State University, and Sherry Proctor at CUNY, at Queens College, at City University of New York. So I do want to first and foremost mention them, because without them, the paper just would not exist at all. And these are longtime collaborators. And also, I look up to all of them as mentors. I mean, not only academically, but just generally. More senior to me in terms of their level of scholarship, their level of intellect and thinking. And so I do want to kind of highlight them first and foremost, especially Sherry Proctor, who is such an important figure in school psychology. And I encourage everyone to go forth and to read all of Sherry Proctor's papers. She's much work, not only in terms of studying the well-being of Black students, for example. She's also done a lot of work studying our own field in school psychology and shining a light on school psychology. So I do want to highlight that for a second. I also want to highlight, as Star mentioned earlier, Dr. Collette Ingram, right, who is maybe in this particular way maybe a spiritual predecessor to me. I read her 2000 paper on multicultural consultation, and I thought, well, this is amazing, and actually inspired me to I would say it kept me going in terms of like my scholarship, right? So I read her 2000 paper, and I just thought, wow, like this is really incredible idea. As a school psychologist, you can also think about new ways to kind of approach the field and think about new ways, things like inequality, to tackle things like racial prejudice and all the other kind of inequities that we kind of face. So I do want to highlight that. But I will say that when I was thinking about that framework, I said, well, this is so amazing, and it's been about 20 years since that came out. In what ways has our world changed, right? One of the ways in which the world has changed is that there is much more acknowledgement of folks who are gender diverse, or diverse in terms of their gender identity, sexual orientation. So, we used GSD, gender and sexually diverse language, in the paper. I will not take credit for that name. I will, the editors of the paper suggested that name as being more inclusive. So, and I'm very, very happy that they did. So originally we had the title of the paper was a multicultural LGBTQ plus affirming school-based consultation framework, which is the term that maybe most people are more familiar with. But they said gender sexually diverse is more inclusive, right? It kind of leaves the door open to more identities. And so I thought, well, let's take Colette's 2000 framework, and what if we integrated stuff that is more in touch with gender and sexual orientation intersectionally, right? So like, what if we talk about intersectional supportive consultee learning and development instead of just learning and development, right? Which is the original language that Colette used. Or what if we talk about not only understanding of saliency of race and ethnicity, as Colette originally phrased it, but what if we talk about understanding of saliency of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and gender identity? So I'm also talking about the interaction thereof of all these different identities, right? So essentially, the long story short version is that we should not only start with understanding our own culture, and Star mentioned that earlier, right? That's where it all begins. And then understanding the impact of racism, right, on the students we work with, on the systems we work with. But we should also have, heterosexism and cissexism in the mix. Like, how have these systems of discrimination, those systems of discrimination that target gender and sexuality, what's the impact of that, right? So in maybe the original consultation framework, understanding the impact of racist systems would maybe look at what are our expectations, how are expectations of students different based on what race or ethnicity they are, or what assumptions do we have based on their race or ethnicity. And the gender sexual orientation piece is slightly different. It's not exactly the same, because often those identities can be invisible, right? We don't know if someone is questioning their gender identity. We don't know if someone is questioning their sexual orientation or is keeping that a secret and so on and so forth, or chooses not to reveal to anyone, right? But we shouldn't go in assuming that their identities are the identities that we are A, most comfortable with, or B, that society says we should expect, right? And even if they do let us know, we shouldn't assume that, their expression is in within a specific way or within a specific frame, right? So it starts out with the assumptions, but it is something that we should constantly be aware of. Even if everyone involved identity and heterosexual, right? Cisgender and heterosexual. Even if everyone involved identifies as such within the consultee client kind of triangle, it doesn't matter because, our own assumptions, we should question our assumptions regardless, right? We should not act as if they are, willing and, proper participants in this system, this sort of heterosexist system that we set up with. Everyone can benefit from questioning the heterosexist norm, for example, right? And also, it also starts with how we have either benefited or how we have supported that heterosexist, cissexist, racist norm, right? So it's kind of, it works similar to the original model in that it starts with a questioning, right? And it ends with affirmation and affirmation of multiple viewpoints, and questioning really the power structures that we have set up. It starts with yourself and ends with questioning that assumption. But it's different in that, it's not that we should only apply this model when we suspect that the client in question is, for example, identifies as trans or identifies as bisexual, what have you, right? Like it applies regardless. And now that I'm kind of talking about it, I think that the original model kind of works the same way. I mean, if you have apparent cultural similarities, or I would say superficial cultural similarities, like you should still question your own assumptions, right? You're about how the other person, the consultee, client, how they're expressing their culture, or how they are bonding with their culture. I'll be a little bit more specific. I would say that if someone were to approach me with maybe a median or mean level of schema of how you should approach a Jamaican person, they would get some things pretty dead on, and they would get some things very, very, very incorrect, right? And so I think that works with all of us,
Yeah,
right?
I
Does
love
that
it
make
really
sense?
holds that idea of not knowing about
Yeah.
everything. And I wonder whether there actually perversely could be something really freeing if we could really embrace the idea of, well, look, we all look substantially the same, so it's probably this, and it's probably if the benefit of that framework, Jeff, in terms of saying actually it doesn't matter, you
Right.
constantly enter into a spirit of, well, it might not be.
It might not be, right?
Yeah, and because I think the other thing that young people, particularly now, I think they're so amazing at pushing back on the restrictions around fixedness, and I suppose I do well my kind of clinical work more with adolescents and young adults, and really recognizing how the capacity to be able to flex and kind of embrace some aspect of oneself, and then 6 months later be like, nah, that's not, it to that developmental typicality and allowing for that. I think there's something really amazing about the framework in, like, from the very get-go, being able to be, actually, I don't know anything about these people, and I want to find out more.
It's and it
Yeah.
sounds so it sounds so basic, but it's so
It's
it's so
profound.
important, right? And
Yeah,
yeah, and
absolutely.
I you say use the word freeing, and I will say that, I'm a identify as a queer person, a gay man, and so I talk a lot, maybe again more in an informal way, right? About how like queerness is about liberation in a lot of ways, right? Like it is liberation from expecting a certain script in terms of gender norms, in terms of norms of sexual orientation. It is very freeing. It's like you get to sort of make up your own rules to a certain extent. Of course, we're still human, so there's still conformity and all this, but there is liberation in a individual way. So like, what if we kind of look at this liberation from a more systemic lens? I do want to ask Star if I may take over interviewer role for like a second, right? Because Star is actually trained by Colette and others, Colette and colleagues. So she was, I dare say, Star, you're maybe more trained in this kind of approach, at least more similar to this approach than I was. So I don't know, could you talk about how any of these kind of steps, how they look in practice, especially as a trainee?
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate your work so much, Jeff. I love reading your article, and it really speaks to, I think, what we do every day in the field, right? And it's so funny to hear you talk about it because you keep saying it's so basic, and I don't think it's basic at all. I think it really is. It needs to be said, right? And although, even the notion of just challenging these systems, even though it's kind of like that's where we should start. That's a great starting point. It also needs to be said. It needs to be talked about. It needs to be practiced on a regular basis. I think it also really speaks to the collaborative nature, right? You talked a lot about like liberation, and I think when we are thinking about consultation and kind of the collaborative problem solving that we go through with the consultee, that also brings opportunities for liberation, right? In that we're doing this together, right? We're challenging our own maybe assumptions that we have about gender and sexuality and identity, and also doing that with the consultee at the same time. So I think that that's such a big part of what we do as consultants, and I think it happens every time we're meeting even informally with teachers and educators and administrators. I think that starts ultimately with us, right? As we had kind of previously spoken about, but really just challenging the system that we work in, and then also really thinking about how that's reflective of the larger system that we're all kind of a part of, right? How these schools are essentially just microcosms of the larger system, and how we can start that.
I mean, it was something that you were touching on, Jeff, about the sort of what Colette wrote about in 2000. And there's a part in your paper where you're talking about the need to really think about gender and sexually diverse identities specifically, rather than just sort of using the default kind of idea of cultural competence. And kind of alongside that emphasis that, the you and the people that you wrote the paper with about working at different levels. That it isn't just about working with an individual child or young person in their context, but it's also about the kind of wider structure and system. And one example of a system level response you gave was exactly that, about not just saying, there's a professional competency in working in a culturally responsive way, but that you really do need to kind of address specifically something about the distinctive nature of each person and who they fully are. And yeah, we just thought that was such an interesting point, and about competencies generally, and thinking about either pre-train, like in initial training, Zara's newly qualified kind of competencies that you would develop across your career. We were just wondering if both of you would speak a little bit to this idea that any one aspect of identity, whether that's, race, ethnicity, language, could be subsumed into this idea of cultural competence and what might get missed.
I will say that cultural competency is, I feel like we've tried to like shed that term and like adopt others, but it sticks, right? Like it sticks for a reason, just because it is so all-encompassing in a way. When we think of cultural competency, or like when I was training, which again wasn't that long ago, it was defined in a fairly it's not even that it was explicitly defined in a strict way. Like It's not only it's not that they train us to say cultural competency is only about race or ethnicity, or cultural competency is only about challenging racism, right? Like, especially as it exists in the US context. But it wasn't explicitly said, but it was sort of like implicitly like, well, that was the implicit message, just because race and ethnicity is such a salient part of US culture. So it was sort of implicitly about that, right? And there was sort of lip service being given to, well, but yeah, you know, here's other things, right? Like language and sexuality and so on and so forth. So I think that really integrating these other parts, right? These other identities and these other axes of identity to the forefront of cultural competency is not necessarily saying that, okay, but racism is like less important or race ethnicity is less important. On the contrary, like these other identities really intersect with race in a very important way, right? And we shouldn't give that short thrift, right? And again, it comes down to what you said, Emma, about this overall question about like, how does this person express their race, ethnicity, and sexual orientation? How do these various aspects intersect in a way, right? Let's start from a place of not knowing, and let's start from a place of not assuming. And let's start from a place of like reflecting on our own experiences, right? So, you know, I can think of clients I've worked with who ostensibly have the same kind of salient racial identities, but who express it in such different ways, right? Vastly different ways. So that's kind of a start of like how I think about cultural competency in this kind of way. And I don't know. I feel like it's not to put you on blast, Star, but I can think of so many times that you and your colleagues, your classmates, you've had cases in practicum or an internship that also ring true to this. I don't know if you any come to mind, or if you could speak to that.
Yeah, definitely. And it's okay. Put me on blast. It's okay. Yeah, I will say I think I really appreciate kind of Jeff's emphasis on intersectionality, right? And I think that there is kind of this shift in education where although there is like a lot of importance in developing, you know, cultural competencies and what does that look like and culturally responsive teaching. And, you know, in education, I feel like you have one professional development day, maybe once a semester, where you cover some cultural competencies and then you walk away from the training and you're like, I feel culturally competent, right? But what does that really look like in practice, right? How are you integrating that into not only your everyday interactions with students and families, and educators, but also in your everyday life? Like, I used to joke with a lot of my cohort members or my colleagues, my classmates, and I remember we had talked about, you know, how we had gotten to grad school, and we had asked each other, you know, was this your dream job? Was this your dream job? And one of my colleagues had said, you know, I don't really like think of school psychology as a dream job or like a dream career, right? This is really just like a dream community role. Like, this is how I see my life evolving, and this is the values that I have in my life I want to also integrate into my practice, right? And I think that really speaks to also this idea of expanding cultural competencies to be a lot more holistic. Like, a lot of us are not just the three or four salient identities that, you know, someone sees in us when we show up into a classroom or when we walk into a room, right? The kind of like three or four most salient identities, a lot of us have just varied experiences. So for example, I work a lot, right, with Indigenous students and families, and there are so many kind of diverse experiences just within a lot of Indigenous communities and cultures, due to, you know, historical contexts, colonization, all of these different factors. And working with one Indigenous student is going to look very, very different from working with another Indigenous student and family. I have some students who have a breadth of cultural knowledge and know about their traditional languages and their traditional cultural practices and everything. And so a lot of our work together is making them feel empowered to express themselves in that way, and also advocating for that in the classroom and in like the school system. I work with some Indigenous students who, because of colonization and because of certain historical impacts of, American legislation and things like that, they're a lot more disconnected, right? There has been just such a long history, I think, of really horrible things that have happened to not just Indigenous communities, but I think a lot of other marginalized communities. And so, working with one student who may have these experiences because of these identities, I think just looks so different than the next student, right? And I think that that's what Jeff is really speaking to, is thinking about this intersectionality and thinking about, how we work with our students in a more holistic way, which I really appreciate.
There's no sort of one size fits all when it comes to that. And it is actually very attractive to like into the general sort of school psych population to be like, what's an intervention I could do for X population? Right. Instead of that, think about like, how can I change my approach and my thinking to better serve a variety of students or families who may be diverse in terms of their race or ethnicity, or a student who may identify as not heterosexual, may identify as queer, may identify as trans, what have you, right? In what ways can I change my thinking and my approach? In what ways is my sort of approach not conducive to identities that fall outside the dominant or the mainstream? But I will say that that initial part, right, it's very clean. That's why it's so attractive, right? It's because you can do an hour of training and then you say you're qualified. It's so seductive, I would say, is the right word for it, right? And that kind of stuff, it sounds good to funders, which, as we know, all of us on this call, make the world go round in a way, right? It's very attractive. It's the establishment, right? But I'm really trying to push against that as much as I can.
I love that there's the same sense, Jeff, there of kind of the spirit of not knowing. Like you couldn't possibly, like Star saying, having one professional development event and then be like, I am the most culturally competent person that has ever existed. Done. Let me move on to reading. You are emphasizing this continual need and lifelong idea about we will never know, and therefore we need to keep inquiring, which is one of the brilliant parts about this job and being able to continue to do that. But in the other bit about not knowing, like almost that menu option of I have X child or X young person, what's the intervention? And like I'll select it out of a menu. Because we've literally just recorded an episode with somebody who's really interested in service user involvement and consultation, particularly how do you better include children and young people in consultation. And what you've just said kind of links for me a little bit about what Anne was talking about, which is, well, we don't know what would be a good intervention for a gay Black student. So why don't we ask them? And why don't we have them and say that we genuinely don't know, but we'd love to hear what you would could. I mean, she's some of the examples she was just giving about what gets missed when young people aren't included in consultation. I don't, Zara, she was giving an example about like changing for PE and absolutely hating getting changed for PE. And the one thing that would have made such a big difference about experiences of feeling like they belonged and that they could be included was if that part could be addressed, but none of the adults, the consultees or consultant, had really considered what would be some. I'm not saying in any way like that's the answer to everything, but the real importance of remembering we don't know about clients and the significance, or consultees and the significance of asking, I think really kind of comes through in both of those points that you're making.
100%, 100%. It's just not knowing, and philosophers who are much more brilliant than I am have kind of maybe stated it more succinctly or eloquently than I ever could. But that's definitely the kind of spirit that I constantly take. I'm not this spirit of not knowing. And I will say, to your point about asking the students what they want, or asking the students what they need to know, the speaking to this very kind of participatory kind of framework, right? I see it. I wish I had their permission to say that, to say who it was, just because they do it so brilliantly. But this school I'm working with in Germany, this teacher who is championing this systems-based project, essentially, He's been such an expert, his approach, but really, genuinely trusting the students, as experts and really facilitating that. I would say that is, I mean, again, I'm learning. I'm like, oh wow, this is truly participatory work.
Yeah, I think that also kind of speaks to a little bit of what Star was saying in terms of like that holistic kind of approach and really, I guess, working with what works for that young person, because no two young people are going to be the same, no matter whether they identify with the same gender or sexuality or race. And yeah, it's quite interesting because as you guys were talking, I was really stuck on the word of like cultural competence. And that competence kind of feels like there's somewhere to reach, and now you're competent. I've been thinking about that a lot, but I guess in some of the new competencies that we have in the doctoral training, that's one of them. And I guess it says like we would have demonstrate knowledge and understanding of characteristics such as race, religion or belief, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, social class, and their intersection. And kind of that's relevant to practice. And the concept of intersectionality is really prominent in your framework. But equally, sometimes it can be less well understood. And I was just wondering if we could maybe expand a little bit about, you know, how aspects of intersectionality are attended to in the framework.
So yeah, that's a great question, and I will, point to Kimberly Crenshaw, her 1989 right paper on intersectionality as the coiner of the term, the originator of the term intersectionality. Again, such a when you read the concept, you're like, of course, but then you also realize that that's not necessarily the default kind of way of approaching things, right? So, specifically in this framework, I mean, there isn't much difference than how the original term was intended, right? So essentially, we look at, say, for example, someone's race or ethnicity and how that basically intersects with other aspects of their identities. So, for example, a student who identifies as cisgender and Black, right, and female. She may be facing issues due to how she is perceived as a black girl, as a Black youth, that may differ fundamentally both within her community and outside her racial ethnic community. I can think of a student who I worked with who is Black, and they were gender nonconforming at the time, and most of their teachers, if not all of their teachers, were white, cisgender. They may not, the teachers might see this student's behavior going out in, we were in New Orleans at the time, right? So they may see the student going out with their friends at night in certain parts of New Orleans as, quote unquote, deviant behavior or quote unquote, part of their constellation of their kind of emotional behavioral diagnoses. They might view it through that light. Oh, they're staying out past curfew, or they're being maybe some, quote unquote, naughty or bad or what have you. Again, I want to clarify that, these teachers and these staff members, they may have ultimately very positive perceptions of the student and, want the student to be great. And some of the teachers may even, love the student in a way, kind of like a faux parental kind of role, and may have taken on that role. And I will emphasize that they may think nothing but great things about the student, but they may view the student's behavior through a frame of they're doing something kind of bad versus they are seeking out other people of their own identity, or they're affirming their own identity essentially, right, by going out and dressing up and listening to music and so on and so forth. Like, they might view that less as a affirmation and more as a behavioral difficulty, even though, again, ultimately they may still be doing really, really good things for the student, right? So in that case, right, the teacher would need to, or the staff members, not only the teachers, I don't want to kind of pinpointed on teachers, not only teachers, admin, staff members, school psychologists. I'm using teacher to kind of like as a catch-all, right? Adults. They should in that situation, or they may want to in that situation, question their own biases, question their own cultural frame, which says that, students should not be going out at night and dressing up and doing all these things, right? And again, maybe they shouldn't from a safety perspective, but again, it's a behavior that's coming up from a need, right? So it's about identifying a student's need to seek affirmation, right? Because they don't have that by default, right? There's no one in their immediate environment doing that. So again, if they just view the student as they are a Black student or they are a queer student, they may miss some of that nuance because sometimes, so some of those adults or staff members or what have you, their default of gay or queer might be a very sort of stereotypically white idea that they see on TV, right? Or that they see in Hollywood. Or their idea of Black might be, again, a very kind of monolithic flat idea of like, this is where Black people go to feel affirmed. They go to church, or this is what they do. This is what they do. They may have like a very like set idea of what it is versus like flexibly thinking like, okay, because of these students' identities, they seek affirmation in this place. The thing is that like another student of their own, another Black queer student might be seeking affirmation, on the internet, right? And that the era that I'm thinking of, that student existed, that Black queer student might be looking on Tumblr, right, for affirmation, right? Or so it, does that make sense? It's sort of like kind of that flexibility and that kind of fundamentally questioning of assumptions.
Yeah, I mean, I know we don't have the time to, but one of the things I suppose, Star, when you're talking about kind of colonialism and what that has done in the States, and kind of I'm also thinking about how faith and how challenging, I guess, personally, I can find faith, based on where I'm from and how I've grown up. Because Jeff, you touched on the word about morality and how people can say, like, expressing care in many ways and very altruistic ways and in very intended to be mindful ways, but are experienced as policing somebody's attempts at seeking community or, exploring who they are and really interested. But I guess I was also thinking about how colonized one's mind can become and that inability to question, why am I thinking this is problematic or an issue or framing it as a deficit behavior or something to do with an emotional disturb? Where has all that come from? And again, the significance of the framework starting with some sort of interrogation of your own as the consultant. Why have I decided that the default right or norm or whatever kind of language you might use, that's the kind of way? And then anything else that's different is somehow deviating, whether that's in a neutral way or potentially in quite a negative way. But it is also making me think about how do we keep that capacity to not know, particularly as you transition from internship to newly qualified, from newly qualified early career and as you go on, and how do you not lose the capacity to just sort of wonder? Because one of the things, I guess, to try and link those two things together and start to ask you about this specifically, in some of the papers that we see in, I'm assuming what you would read in your graduate studies or in your internship is around minority stress frameworks. I know that is mentioned in the paper that Jeff wrote with his colleagues, but I think that some of what's attended to in that idea is we might talk about how power is operating in people's lives. And maybe I'd be more used to kind of, but I guess what I was wondering about, the importance of taking account the wider system around a child or young person rather than just locating a difficulty within them. And how we try to understand that actually this isn't necessarily about deficits or deviancy or in that kind of way. And not to say locate a mental health need in an individual when actually the systems around them are quite toxic. And yeah, I was just wondering about is that how have I understood minority stress framework in a sort of similar way, or there are bits missing in that, and how important is that kind of framework in some of the consultation that you're doing currently in your internship?
No, I think that is such an important question, and I think you're touching on so many So many important points when it comes to the realities of the students that we work with, right? I think such a big piece of that as well that I've experienced in my internship has been how colonization has impacted students and their families and their own ideas about their identities, right? So I like to think of, like, in my community, traditionally as an Indigenous woman, my tribes, there was this kind of belief that gender was a very fluid idea and a fluid concept. And a lot of the times there were these traditional terms, pre-colonization, that we would use to describe certain members of our community, to where it wasn't just man and woman, but there were, two-spirited individuals as well. And that was really acknowledged and valued. And I think, after colonization and kind of the period we're in now, and a lot of my students, there has been, I think, this interesting transition of, like, growing up on the reservation and growing up with kind of these introductions to these new values, right? Or coming to school off of the reservation and really experiencing this is reflective of the dominant culture, right? Which is not reflective of how they grew up or what's traditional to their own, cultural ideas and beliefs. So that's also been interesting as well, right? Where it's not so much the student is has these deficits or the student is deviant, but as you were mentioning, it really is about the larger system, right? It really is about the school system and how to further work with the system. I think that's our job as consultants, right? Is really trying to make those adjustments and challenge those systems and bring up these conversations and challenge these assumptions for sure.
What you just said was really interesting. And I guess when I was thinking of, the different contexts you go into when you come from, a different community and then you go into the school community, it's slightly different and kind of that, I guess, cognitive dissonance in a way. But also the impact that has on young people forming their identities and that kind of just an interesting point that I just thought that it really impacts young people and their kind of sense of, well, who am I and how am I becoming who I am? And but yes, I guess we don't have a lot of time. So we'd like to come a little bit to the consultation framework itself and kind of the five domains. And maybe I won't list them all out, and it would be really lovely to kind of hear a little bit just about the framework and its use at the moment.
Right. So the long and short of it is, again, this is mirrors Ingram's 2000 framework very closely, right? But it's modified, as I say in the paper, it's slightly modified framework to include gender, sexually diverse populations or considerations, right? And I like that, Emma, you mentioned earlier power, like talking about power, because power is definitely inherent within this as well, right? It's less about, oh, we're all standing from like an equal foot, and more about like, okay, in what ways do the power structures that we exist in as society tilted? Like, so there are five domains, as Zara mentioned. The first is thinking about the consultants, thinking about your own learning and development. So like, what knowledge do you have of issues affecting gender and sexually diverse populations, right? So that is like, what do you know about the current legislation, right, in the US and in other countries as well, actually, that are the pushback against the freedom and liberation of LGBTQ or GSD individuals, right? How does that disproportionately affect GSD as people of color, students of color, right? How does the very, not only laws and not only policies, but how does the rhetoric, how is that affecting students or these families? And on the opposite hand, what supports are available? Like what are kind of like aspects of the community that makes them built to really withstand these kinds of attacks? And what are the aspects of this community that that have enabled them to develop such resiliency over the centuries, right? That have made them able to withstand this prejudice, this discrimination over time. Like, why is this such a why is this such a strong, awesome, amazing community or set of communities, right? Across race or ethnicities, and how does that look different in different societies and different cultures, and how does that look essentially? So it's really about educating ourselves, right? First, And not only that, not only like, what can we read from the books, but like, how does our own background and our own culture, how does that affect our perceptions, right? This and stuff like that. Some of that you can learn from people, right? You can learn by getting to know people. Not only people you have to work with, but also people in your community, right? I mean, in the US, even in small towns, there are LGBTQ centers, stuff like that. And again, there's so many resources available online. That's the first domain. The section, it's supporting consultee learning and development. So who you're working with and how could you help them to learn more about whatever it is, if it's meeting them where they're at in terms of their own knowledge and their own cultural competency and their own issues, and not pretending to be better at quote unquote better cultural competency or what have you, but really just like seeing your differences and kind of meeting halfway and kind of as Dara said earlier, kind of bridging that divide. But then it moves on to how do cultural similarities between different stakeholders, how does that interact within a school system, which is also a cultural system? So like how do your own cultures, how does that intersect with the school culture, and how did the school culture develop, right, historically, and how is that influenced by larger society? So the third domain really situates a school as a system than wider set of systems. Again, it goes back to Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who I beat my students over the head with in the first year class I teach there. And then the fourth domain kind of goes to variation. So that's what I mentioned earlier about, okay, there are many different, so we have both within person variations and between person variations, right? So for example, as I said, no two people who identify as the same thing, identities, there no two people are the same. So that interpersonal variation, but also, it could be I'm a cisgender, Black mixed race, immigrant, male, school psychologist, who may be working with someone with like an assortment of identities who are different or the same, and the client might also be an assortment of identities that are different or the same. So like, there's so many different ways that are. There are so many different combinations. And so how does this unique combination is really a play out? How does this dynamic play out? Partially because of our kind of like different dynamics in terms of orientations and in terms of cultural identities, but also despite that, right? Like what similarities do we have? What cultures do we share? And then after that, it's just really essentially like support, as I said earlier, it ends with affirmation, right? It starts with knowledge, it ends with affirmation. So again, it's affirming them in their own identity and their own culture, and having that, having the consultee and the consultant kind of match in terms of like affirming our own relationship, right, as a consulting client. So that's the long and short of it. The thing is, it can look so different. Depending on the situation, the circumstances, and as Emma said earlier, the power differential, right? Like, are you as the consultant, do you also have grant funding behind you, right? Like that is a lot of kind of institutional power, right? Or are you a student? Are you a practicum student, and you're the consultant, and you're kind of like tolerated, but maybe you have a lot of relational power with the client who really respects you and who you have really good rapport with. So that is also power in itself, right? That's relational power. So also looking at that. That's the long and short of it. I left out a lot, but that's the long and short of it.
No, that's amazing. Thank you so much. And we just definitely wish we had so much more time
Yeah,
to go
yeah.
into framework. But I would say maybe before we go to our last question, and we obviously want everyone to go away and read on the paper and reflect on some of the things that we've spoken about a bit more, is posted on our Twitter. But if both of you had kind of one takeaway or major thing that you'd want people to know from the paper, is there one thing that you could both say maybe?
I would say that the world has changed rapidly between the time this paper was conceived and now. and in so many ways. And so I would encourage people to think about how they would rewrite the framework today, right? I don't know if that really counts as a takeaway, but like I don't know if I see things that way anymore. So the takeaway is this like constant evolution, right? Like cultural competency is never kind of static, as Emma said earlier. And think about like what ways that you would modify this framework to suit your own needs or rewrite it to suit your own needs.
Yeah, just to kind of echo that, I think as we had touched on and as we continued, speaking and discussing just this article and the different points that had come up, the world is constantly changing, right? And schools are reflective of that and they will continue to be reflective of that. I think one of the biggest takeaways is also schools are changing, the world is changing, and I think that means our role as school psychologists will also be changing, right? Our kind of values, what we choose to put into practice, how we choose to practice every day with our students and the families that we work with and the educators that we work with is really kind of up to us. And I just really appreciate all of Jeff's work, and thank you so much for having me here.
We do have one last question, which we
Oh,
asked
yeah, sure.
already, which is, if you have one book, chapter, or article that really kind of changed your thinking around consultation or just that you really enjoyed reading.
Sure. There is a book by Dr. Gregory Cahete. It's called Indigenous Community and the Teachings of the Seven Fires. And that one specifically, I think, has really impacted myself and just kind of, again, how I think about the role of school psychology, but also just how to integrate like more holistic and indigenous frameworks into kind of everyday practice, which I really appreciate. And I think really speaks to also consultation and kind of echoing that holistic view and kind of framework that we all kind of work towards.
And I would say, first of all, I'm going to read that book star that you just mentioned. But second of all, Audre Lorde's Sister Outsider. So it's a collection of short stories and essays that really influenced my thinking on power and intersections of sexism, racism, homophobia. So I would, it's not school psych, but it is definitely theoretically and practically very, very important for anyone doing this work to read.
That's amazing. Thank you both so much. Honestly, it's been such an amazing conversation. So much to think and reflect about.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Emma. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.